Hello and welcome to the Claire Solon podcast. We're here with thanks to one of our favourite Irish brands, Sisterly, the multi-award winning multivitamin designed by women for women. Find out more at their website, sisterlylab.com. Hi, greetings everyone. Hello, producer Caroline.
Hi, how are you?
Hi. Caroline attends my meditations in the morning and we chant, but I chant at a level, and Caroline has told me on many occasions that she's had to harmonize with me.
It doesn't matter how hard I try, I cannot get down to your pitch. I'm like that.
There, you see, you got a lovely voice. Speaking of meditation, actually, September is here and we have a fresh new class of meditators, don't we?
We do. So nice to see everyone.
Isn't it? We've had Hannah join, we've had Sinead join, and we've had Helen join. Mm-hmm. So, and what I've noticed, of course, is that now at 6 o'clock in the morning, it's dark.
So dark.
So I'm going to have to get a light and put it in my face because I just look like this sort of ominous outline.
Like Batman sitting in the corner.
An ominous outline.
Oh, very good.
So look, I think we'll get straight into it with my review of my breathwork session.
I have been waiting for this.
Yes, right. We came back from Edinburgh having had a brilliant time. And there was no time to relax. I was straight back into work. And then on Sunday evening, I headed to St. John's Church at Hyde Park in around Marble Arch in London for my 3-hour breath work. Now, obviously a couple of weeks ago, Caroline had done it. And so I had booked it because, you know, got to experience what you've got to also do the, what did my sister call it?
Exposure therapy.
Got to do some exposure therapy. But I must say, full transparency, Sunday came and by the middle of the day I had what can only be described as the Sunday scaries. Really feeling like the sort of anxiety in my belly, thinking, oh God, I have to go to this thing tonight and I'm quite nervous.
What do you think the nerves were for?
Well, that's the thing, because I called you, didn't I, on my way to the bus stop. And I said, oh, were you nervous too? And you said, no, not at all. Absolutely no nerves.
Yeah.
I wonder whether the nerves now, looking back, were a kind of a social anxiety thing, potentially. Maybe it's been a while since I've done something like this on my own.
Yeah.
And I didn't really know where I was going. And I didn't know what I was walking into, even though you told us what had happened. I suppose what I didn't know was how I was going to react to the deep breathing session.
Yes.
So, as I said, I'll be completely honest here. Called my guru in India on the way. First of all, Vivian was following me, which is traumatic at the best of times. She comes as far as, you know, halfway to the bus stop. And all the way, she's coming after me. She's like, meow, meow. It's like leaving your child a creche.
Oh my God.
So hideous. And I was like, I just don't need you to be behind me because I don't want to go. And if you're crying behind me, I'm going to stop and turn around and not go to this. And I've spent 69 quid on this. So I called my guru anyway and I said to him, I'm going to a breathwork workshop. I was kind of waiting for him to be like, you don't need this. Mm. He didn't say that. He said, wonderful, excellent, good networking opportunity. Okay, see you later. Bye. Got on a Lime bike, cycled to the tube station, felt like crying.
Whoa.
So good sign, I thought. I was like, okay, there's tears in there.
Yeah.
I can do this. I can get to the breath work. I can lie down on my yoga mat. I can put on my eye mask and I can bawl my eyes out. Fantastic. Yeah. So anyway, I arrive at St. John's Church. At the door is a lovely, lovely man, a blonde haired guy, quite well built, handsome, and people were queuing to get in, and he was hugging everybody and saying, welcome, how do you feel? And again, very uncharacteristically, I was like, hi, I'm quite nervous. He's like, oh, listen, totally normal. Come on in, get settled. One of our angels will show you where you can put your mat down, and you just do you for the next 3 hours. Divine.
What an invitation that is, huh?
I know. Lovely. Yeah. So in I go, I find a little spot over in this lovely church, gorgeous church, to the left-hand side. I find a little spot from my mat, and then I run to the bathroom and I bump into this girl, you know, where you both hop the same way and then hop the other way and you're like, oh, sorry. So I head into the bathroom, came back out. Who is sitting beside me?
No way.
Only the girl.
Oh my God.
Like, there's 80 to 100 people here. That's weird. So we lie down on our mats and we put on our headphones and we're just told to drift away and to relax, and we'll be getting started very soon. I took that a little bit too literally. I drifted off to sleep and I woke up and opened my eyes. Everybody in the room was on their feet doing the first exercise. So I leap up. I can remember being like, oh, this is so relaxing. Whatever this meditation is they're playing is so relaxing. Wow. And then just something brought me to, and I look up and everybody's standing up. So I stand up and the woman beside me kind of smiles. I'm like, oh, how embarrassing. Then we have to start the partner work, which is a little bit confronting. Then there's a little bit of eye contact. Woo-hoo-hoo. Very intense, about 30 seconds. And then you have to lie down and you're going to do different breathing exercises. And what they do is they basically want to show you the capacity of your torso and how much breath can go in. So at this point, me and my neighbor had started to chat. Well, guess what? She was Irish.
No way. The same girl that you bumped into.
Yeah. Her name was Jo and she was from Cork and she'd been living in London for 25 years. And we had a little bit of a chat. And she had this beautiful sparkler on her engagement finger. Oh, wow. So after we finished, I was like, well, you did very well on that breathing. And might I also say, it seems you've done very well on that ring. This magpie couldn't take her eyes off it. So we had a lovely exchange. And then we lay down and they gave us three options in terms of breathing. I mean, I may have fallen asleep again, let's be honest. But it was so relaxing. Now, I was expecting to shed a tear and I felt like I had tears to cry. It had been a while since I'd had a good crying session. It didn't happen for me. But like you'd said a few weeks ago, I did hear people in the room having all manner of experiences and releases. Mm-hmm. So it's muffled, obviously, because you've got the headphones on and you're listening to music and a guided meditation. But I was able to hear really primal sounds.
Yeah, you can hear that they're coming from their toes almost, can't you?
Yes, really guttural sounds. So we then got up and he was kind of encouraging people to give each other hugs and stuff. But I think when you've had releases like that or you've had an experience, you just want to self-soothe. You don't really want to hug anybody. So that would be my only feedback on that. I don't think that hugs should be, I mean, they're not compulsory, of course, but I don't even think they should be suggested at that time because you're trying to take care of your own nervous system. Yeah, I felt wonderful after it, like really, really relaxed. And I spoke to my friend Jo, and Jo said, how'd you get on? And I said, yeah, it was really relaxing. And she said that she'd had a release. So we went over and we used the bathroom afterwards. And I was kind of thinking, like, I'm going to get Jo's number and hopefully I can meet her for coffee. So we got back over to our mats and I was just, you know, rolling my mat up and getting my socks and shoes back on. And then Jo was like, okay, nice to meet you. See ya. And she disappeared into the night.
Oh no, Joe, come back.
My best friend that never was. Gone.
Oh, so she just came in then to be a support for that evening.
Yes, I suppose that's true. Oh my God, I never thought of it like that.
Yeah.
So she was like a temporary fix for my nerves.
Yeah.
Oh, mm-hmm. That's lovely. Yes. She came in. Okay, if we say friendship is a reason, a season, a lifetime, she was there for a reason.
Exactly.
Oh, that's nice. And I also forgot because she had said she'd had quite a release. So going back to the hugging, she just didn't want to hang around outside the church and talk about how she met her fella, which was exactly what I was going to ask her.
We love a meet cute.
So that was my exposure therapy for this week. You were back at Toastmasters, weren't you?
I was. I was back at Toastmasters this week and I was trying to come up with 100 different reasons as to why I can't go.
No way.
And couldn't come up with a single reason why I shouldn't or can't go. Mm. So yeah, the resistance was huge this time. I suppose because I knew what was ahead of me.
Yes.
I was thinking, oh God, I'm going to have to talk and no.
Yes.
So anyway, I went and Ashton showed up again as well. So fair play to her.
Nice.
There was a lot of the same people there this time too. And we sat down beside Anthony, who was the grammarian last week. Okay. And he was the grammarian again this week.
Oh, he loves the grammar, does he?
He loves it. Oh, he does. And he was the word master as well. So he's my kind of guy, right?
What's the word master?
He comes in with a word that needs to be weaved into speeches or answers as often as possible. And you get extra points then. So this week's word was infrangible. And I went, oh, this is a new one for me. I've never heard this. What does this mean?
I've heard of intangible, but never infrangible.
Yeah. So infrangible is something that is unbreakable. And wow. I just thought, oh my God. So he said, let me get this right now. Instead of using the phrase inextricably linked, you can use infrangibly bound.
Glory be. For the good of the realm.
I know.
That's lovely. I must say, I do like inextricably linked. And when I get it in to conversation once a quarter, maybe, if that, I am absolutely pumped.
Yeah.
So now when I come in with my infrangibility cloak, well, people are going to be blown away.
People of London, watch out. Here comes the infrangible Claire Salmon. So unfortunately, infrangible wasn't used that often. But I took it home with me, so that's fine. And then we moved on to speeches and we had a speech that's really stayed with me. It was so beautiful. And this lovely girl got up and she called it The Lost Art of Popping In.
Ooh, lovely.
Yeah. And so she spoke about how we live in an age of instant connectivity, how, you know, we think that we are available to each other all the time because we have our phones. But what's happened is that connection has become scheduled. So we don't just pop into our friends when we're passing by their houses. We don't just give them a call. Everything is, let's check the calendar. Let's see when you're available. Let's plan our connection time. Mm-hmm. And so then you have your friend coming over, you know, on a Sunday morning and you spend all day Saturday cleaning the gaff, making sure that everything's perfect. And she said, you know, if one of my friends knocked on my door on a random Wednesday evening and I was just making my dinner in my gym clothes, she said, that's the real me. And that's the real me that goes unseen. I was like, oh.
Because I think most of us would be offended if someone on a Wednesday evening knocked in and we were in our gym clothes making dinner. We'd be like, oh, as if someone had seen you naked.
Yeah.
You can't see me like this.
Yeah.
Yes. Exactly. That's the Instagram generation, I think. Everything is curated, even IRL.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we've fallen into that trap, regardless of what age we are, of things needing to be perfect before somebody can see me.
Yeah. Like if it wasn't for the amount of deliveries that we get, if the doorbell rang in this age, this digital age of ours, we'd be like, who's that?
What's that noise? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. So it was one of those speeches that just really stayed with me. very thought-provoking. You know, it's okay if your friend pops in for a cup of tea and a chat. She's not here because you have a really clean house or the nice biscuits or whatever. She's just here to see you and see how things have been.
And well delivered?
Exceptionally well delivered. Yeah. I struggled to find any suggestions to make to her because it was just so gorgeous and most certainly food for thought in this digital era of ours.
Yeah, lovely. Nice. Oh, well, that's going exceptionally well.
Yes. Now, I'll have to miss the next one because we're going to Oprah, but that's okay.
Oprah Winfrey. Yes, of course. On the 14th of September.
Yeah.
But you'll have plenty to talk about after seeing her.
Exactly.
Right, before we get into David Ford, part two of our conversation, let's talk supplements, shall we? Big thanks to Sisterly, who are our partners on the podcast, the multi-award winning multivitamin designed by women for women. Each daily powder sachet gives you 23 essential nutrients to support energy, immunity, hair, skin, and hormones. They taste great with no sugar, and the sachets are great on the go. We've been diving into the nutrients available in each sachet since my chat with Christine McGuinness. And this week, we're looking at chicory, right, Caroline?
We are, yes. Chicory root, which is a less known hero, I feel. So chicory root is essentially food for your good gut bacteria. So it contains a prebiotic fiber called inulin, which basically helps to nourish the beneficial bacteria that already lives in your gut.
And I see there's 1,000 milligrams of chicory root in every sachet. Funnily enough, as we were talking about this before we began recording, I was like, chicory, chicory, chicory. Chicory, dickory, doc. And the reason I do is because I bought an organic no-calf coffee alternative made with barley and chicory.
Oh, that's interesting. Ah.
It's delish. So you can get a double hit of chicory once in your Sisterly sachet and once in your no coffee alternative.
And your gut will thank you.
And that's the most important bit. Your gut will say thanks. So Sisterly is a simple daily habit that supports long-term vitality rather than a quick fix. I have been taking it for well over a year now, and I would not part with it. My energy is better. My sleep is better. I feel more balanced, more calm, more like myself. So to find out more, get on their website, sisterlylab.com, and start elevating your everyday this autumn. So thank you very much to those of you who I've spoken to or I've heard from on the David Ford episode. I spoke to my mum actually last night, and she was like, I was worried, Claire. I was just worried whether your audience would be interested in hearing all about football. And I was like, Mom, you've read his book. Did you think we were going to talk about football and nothing else? She was like, no, it was a great conversation. And I think most people did enjoy it. Did you hear the same, Caroline?
I did. Yeah. A lot of people said that it was so nice to hear somebody speak so openly about all of the things that he did speak about, mental health, alcoholism, you know, all of the things that affect so many people.
Yeah, it's been really positive. So big up David Ford. So I made him stick around for another episode. And in this episode, we put football to one side and we take it into his personal life. We talk about marriage. We talk about relationships. We talk about alcohol. And actually, he took some time off alcohol and the impact that made on him and on his family. And then actually, by the end of the episode, David is a coach and a mentor. And well, before I knew it, I was in a coaching session.
Back for part two. After the sweat on part one. I don't know, was it the conversation or was it the weather?
Plenty of reasons to sweat in part one, but let's take it back first of all, because you told me how yourself and your wife, Alison, met, and it was at a wedding in Galway.
Yes, my grandmother used to always tell me, she was a very wise and worldly woman, Nana May. But she'd always say to me, she said, David, you know what? You're going to meet your wife at a wedding. She said that to me since I'd been a young boy. So I come back from West Ham United Football Club one summer, and my good friend Patrick Turk is working in the post office. He gets the invite to go to a wedding in the Galway Bay Hotel. and as a plus one. So we became the OG wedding crashers. We were like, your man, I always forget his name. What's his, you know, the blonde guy?
Owen Wilson.
Owen Wilson. Anyhow, we go to the wedding. Alison walks in. Oh my God, who is she? She's an absolute goddess. And that set the ball in motion. Took a few months. We got together and I call out to our home for the first time, I think it was, knock on the door, come in, meet her mom, her brother, meet Michaela. And we're having the chats and we go down to a room. We're just chilling on the bed, lying on the bed. And we just got chatting about star signs. And she said to me, what's your horoscope? I said, Sagittarius. She goes, you're joking me. She reaches over, pulls up her drawer. She pulls out a coin and it had Sagittarius and on the other side, Gemini. She was a Gemini.
Wow.
So I was like, you're joking me. And like that, as you say, destiny and our whole journey is perfectly described as twin flames.
Where did she find the coin?
It was her, I think it was her communion. And she was only maybe, what's that, 7 or 8? And she's in Oranmore, the village, and an absolute torrential downpour. It was like a monsoon out of India. Gully started to fill. And as she's walking past, she sees this little sparkle, little silver sparkle. And she grabs her mum's hand and the mum's pulling her along. She's like, "Ma," and she reaches down into the gully and she picked up that coin. So then how many years later, Jesus, 15, 20 years later, we end up meeting each other and c'est la vie.
Amazing.
Yeah.
You celebrated 20 years of marriage this year. Congratulations.
Thank you.
You met in Galway and then obviously football intervened and you headed over to Cardiff, I think, was your first stop.
Yes. Go to Cardiff. They offered me the contract, ring up Ali, and I said, look, I want the 2.5 years. They're only willing to give me 1.5 years. What do we do? And she was like, right, let's go for it. The only thing was she was 6 months pregnant.
Whoa.
And that was a bit interesting. And to be honest, she did what not a lot of women would do, actually. She actually went, yeah, look, let's get doctors, let's get gynecologists, we'll have to get all that sorted, baby sorted and everything else. And she went for it. So then in the June, Ella was born. And yeah, we had a beautiful little baby girl. And that's how the journey began in Cardiff all those years ago.
Tell me, over the years, what's been the toughest time or season in your marriage?
It's a lovely way to put it, a season. And I definitely feel marriage is definitely seasonal. You know, when you meet up, the romantic love, first 2 years, and everything's rosy, everything's good, everything's fantastic. You get married, you start to have kids, you start dreaming together, everything else. And then after a certain number of years, what do they call it, 7-year itch. And if you can survive that, you'd probably survive anything. Where the difficulty probably lied for ourselves is the over-reliance and dependence on each other. Because we'd moved away to the UK, we didn't have grannies, grandparents. We were such a tight-knit unit at the time. And that did begin to have a bit of a stretch. I didn't really know how to approach that at the time. Mm-hmm. We've come together as a couple, yet we have to understand that we're individuals also. The roots of codependence, independence, and interdependence, that's ultimately the main aim from my view. And it's something that I see a lot now working with couples, working with men, working with women on those different realms.
What does interdependence look like?
Interdependence is we're together, but we also have our freedom. It's I'm with you through hail, rain, or snow. I need my time. You need your time. We're both individuals, but at the end of the day, we're both tightly bonded and we're both connected. The truest form of interdependence for me is understanding that support and intimacy, that men need support, women need intimacy. And when that joins and that comes together, that equals interdependence.
Very nice. You and I spoke about this a lot. Men need support, words of encouragement.
Mm-hmm.
And then I suppose the intimacy that women love is that sit down and talk to me.
Look, to be honest, what I find is working with people and doing that work with myself and with Alison. A lot of this stuff we know, yeah, but understanding it is a whole different scenario.
Yeah.
Women love the intimacy, as you say. Can you come home? Can you have a conversation? Can you sit in the sofa? Can you have a chat about the day? They want to be listened to. They want to be heard. where men come in and all they hear is the damsel in distress. I fix, I repair. And oftentimes the best thing that I learned through my relationship is that certain situations aren't there to be healed or fixed or repaired or any of those different elements. What was actually really important and really relevant was that Ali just needed to be witnessed and to be heard. Then on the flip side of that, where men sometimes just, you know, they feel that, and I often felt that as well as a professional athlete, that it felt like I was always in battle mode. I was always the warrior. I was always fighting. I was either fighting against the opposition. I was fighting against teammates that wanted my position. I was fighting with managers through the stories and everything else that you've already heard, and fans and everything else. Everything felt like an assault on the senses. Mm-hmm. So therefore, home for me was my sanctuary. I just needed peace, quiet, tranquility. What the biggest probably issue was my heedlessness and my lack of focus and my lack of concentration, because I was either caught in the past of a mistake or what happened in training, or worried or concerned about, Jesus, how will I get the mortgage paid this month? I made a mistake. Will I get back in the team? Am I going to be in the team for Saturday? Mm-hmm. So I was never really fully present for my wife and my children in those days and in those ages. So that's what led to me understanding, right, what do I need to do here? Where do I need to go? And look to heal this inside of myself.
You've struck on something that I've often asked myself, and I observed it in my father, and I have done in relationship with men, you know, as an adult. Mm-hmm. And I've, even with bosses, I guess, and colleagues, I found myself tiptoeing around, wanting to offer words of support or to connect, but not knowing how. Can you give us as women some advice on that? You know, you come home, you're stressed, you're clearly not here, you're not present. What's the best course of action for us to get the presence back?
Good question. And the one thing that just keeps jumping into my mind at the moment is, what do you need right now? Mm. And it's very simple. What do you need from me right now? You know, do you need some food? Do you need to vent and really set up that space? So therefore, I do believe that a well-formed, open-ended question and allowing someone to really tap into what they currently need.
That's an excellent question, I think, that can be applied, obviously, to both parties, because perhaps whoever's been in charge sees the other come home and says, tag, you're it, you know? Whereas actually for you both to take off your day and decant all of the stresses of your day, the best thing to say to each other is, what would you like now? I'd like to go for a walk. What would you like now? I'd like something to eat. Right, let's work this out.
Yeah, exactly. Can we find compromise? Mm. And if we can find the compromise, we're going to be caught between collaboration and competition. And that's one of the biggest things with relationships, is when they get caught in competition, which may look like power struggles. I spoke to one of my clients in America, and he's just got engaged. And I said, in your life, are you your MVP in your life? And he started dancing around there. And I said, answer me question. Are you the MVP, the most valuable person in your life? And danced around it, didn't want to go to it. And I said, just please answer me question. And he went, no, man, I'm not the MVP in my life. And he goes, how do I be the MVP in my life? And I said, well, you got to be the MVP, the most vulnerable person.
Ooh.
Yeah. So the most valuable person is the one that's willing to put it on the line, that's willing to take the last minute free throw, that's willing to take the last minute penalty, that's willing to miss, that knows the consequences, but yet sees the back of the consequences as a huge gain and a huge expansion.
What impact does the wounds or the traumas from our own childhood and our own lives make on a marriage or a union? You know, how can people stand in front of their loved one and recognize that what's happening is not about what's happening right now, but what happened 25, 30 years ago?
Yeah, it's a great pickup. In simple terms, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. You know, monkey see, monkey does. And, you know, oftentimes I used to look at it and sometimes I'd behave like my father. Sometimes I'd behave like my mother. And the fascinating element is that, well, Ali would be in the same situation. In ancient cultures around the world, and especially in the African tribes, is the first thing they look at is, well, before we get married, before we make that vow to each other, we will look at that baggage. We will look at, well, what needs to be addressed. Am I marrying my mother or am I marrying my father?
Wow.
You know, and there was often times I'd often feel that, Jesus, I feel like I'm being mothered here. I'm not looking for a mother. I'm looking for a wife. I'm looking for a partner. And I'm sure that she was on the other side going, Jesus, stop acting like me, dad. I don't need a father here. I need a husband. The biggest thing I've started to look at is our conditioning and our intentions, mm-hmm. you know, and that's part of our conditioning, but our intention isn't actually feed into those conditions, but we actually do.
Yes.
When we stop and we pause and we actually go, hang on a second, Ali, and she'd often say to me, that wasn't my intention to say that or say it that way. And you're like, all right, that's interesting. Now with that intention, the mind will move to the heart and it'll go to the right place. That way the intensity will be regulated in the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Or if the intensity isn't right, it's cold, it's too low.
Yes.
And if the intensity is too high, it's too much fire, it's too much fight.
I heard somebody say on a podcast yesterday, you can start a brand new relationship with the same person.
Beautiful. Love that.
You know, many, many years in. But I think what you and I worked through with Dennis, our coach and mentor, and through adoption of spirituality and practices like meditation, is a focus on self that mm-hmm. requires you to be the best version of yourself. And so when you start showing up as a better version of yourself, then your relationships have an opportunity to progress.
Yeah, absolutely. The big question is, you know, what is self? Hmm. Yeah. What does self even look like? You know, for me, that was what triggered the whole journey. When my grandmother passed away and I asked that question, I said, what's life all about? And I'm fundamentally the longer I go on is to understand that it's about remembrance of self. Yeah. Don't lose yourself because we can get caught in relationships with others, with wife, children, and I even see it with Ali, and you know how she's an amazing, amazing mother. That was one of the biggest things, that one of her biggest traits when I met her. I was like, oh my God, she's such a phenomenal mother. And that was one sacrifice that she met. She lost herself in that. She lost her confidence, because then when it came to kids are old enough and big enough, she was like, right, I'm now beginning to remember me. And I often find that women do that wholeheartedly. Women are amazing at looking after everybody and not themselves. Mm-hmm. And trying to get to that place of trying to get a woman into that space, working with them to put themselves first is like getting into a circus with a tiger.
It's true. Because as women, we don't want that pointed out to us.
Exactly. And that's one of the biggest differences between men. That's why women think, oh, men are being a bit more selfish. They're willing to take care of self a lot more. As a generalization, men are a whole lot better at, like, right, this is what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Where the mother would always be, I have to look after Billy, Johnny, and Jimmy, and Dewey.
That's the problem, I think, for us as women. We're raised in a village. We're very tribal. We're all about the community and other people. And we're rewarded for that.
Mm-hmm.
You get your badge of honor, you become the good girl. And then what happens is that resentment builds up when you see either A, people not returning as much as you've given, or why we resent men, because we see men looking after themselves and we think, I'm over here slaving away.
And that's what I mean. It's really understanding the differences between man and woman.
Mm.
You know, how willing they are to look at their differences. And in their differences is going to be difficulties. Not being right, but putting it right. And I've always said it, I do believe that the pyramid of relationships is that man and woman come together. They have to be at the apex. They have to be at the top. Mm-hmm. Then comes the children. Then comes family. Then comes friends. Yeah. Oftentimes it's inverted.
Yes.
Oftentimes kids come first. Friends come first. Everyone else comes first. And what happens in a relationship is that the man and woman start to separate, and all of a sudden both parties are missing each other. Mm-hmm. So it's a, you know, I as you can tell, you know, you've known me for a long time, Claire. I love getting into relationships and also relationship with self.
You gave up alcohol and your plan was a year, but you ended up doing 9 years. What did that do for you, your relationship with self, and also your relationship with your wife?
Ultimately, what it actually did was it helped me to fall in love with myself.
Wow.
Yeah. So me, by falling back in love with myself, was a major, major element. You know, it was like we rise in love. Mm-hmm. When we fall in love, that isn't actually love, that's attachment. And the root of all suffering is attachment. So when we get attached to something, it's not going to go our way. Now all of a sudden we've placed conditions on that relationship. You're in survival mode. There's not a whole lot of love and belonging. Mm-hmm. People are always talking about belonging and connection though. They don't want to bring the love to it, because they always find that love is fluffy. Love is the hardest thing. Love is the softest thing. Love is absolutely everything. And love is the only thing that conquers fear. So for myself in it, looking at how much I loved myself versus how much I was attached, by me drinking, by me at weekends having a few cigarettes, by me getting angry with myself, by me getting angry with others. So it started to show me how unkind I was being to myself, mm-hmm. and how unforgiving I was being to myself. And through my sobriety of those 9 years, my mind started to get very sober. Mm-hmm. I started to think straight. I could actually see myself. I could start to see my patterns and my habitual behaviors, what were enabling me and disabling me. But the primary reason for stopping was my children. I understood that I didn't want them to be going into a room, into a training room, into a courtroom, into, you know, into a nightclub, into a disco, talking to a girl, talking to a boy, whatever they're into, and feel less than, to feel that level of self-esteem and self-worth and struggle with confidence. And by me chasing the roots back of that and alcoholism and what it actually does to relationships and does to people, it takes the essence out of everything that's actually good. I've seen what it's done to my family. I've seen what it's done to others' families. I've seen what it's done to the relationship with myself. Mm. And as a high performer, it was, you know, it was a release valve as well, where I could go and just let some steam off. But fundamentally after it, I was always fatigued. I was always tired, lack of clarity after it. By the time the weekend came around again, I felt great. And all of a sudden, night on the tiles, and I'm back in that cycle. So I had to break that cycle.
How do those around you cope with your ability to step away from what is a national pastime?
Do you know what? I think it's an international pastime. It's just relationships started to look like almost like a culling, like a beheading. Certain parts of myself that were unhealthy started to fall away, which is, Jesus, this is great stuff. But on the flip side of it, because those parts of me aren't filling certain other relationships, well, they're going to start to fall away also. What was David was, he's great fun, he's great crack. Now all of a sudden he's sober, he's watching us on a night out, people getting suspicious, people getting paranoid. And I'm not that type of person. Like, you want to go dance in your head, dance on the table, you want to say what you want to say, no problem, best of luck with it, you know? I'd never use it against them. So, yeah, I found it very, very interesting in terms of certain teammates, certain friends, certain capacities. People found it very, very difficult that I had stopped drinking, you know?
I didn't do as long as you. I did a year, but I felt the same. I think it felt like a betrayal on both sides. I felt betrayed by people who liked the drinker.
Yeah.
And then they felt betrayed by me that I was stepping away from the sunshine.
Yeah.
In life.
Yeah. So what did the betrayal give you then?
An awful lot of time.
Hmm.
Because, you know, I felt like anytime I went to a pub, I might, you know, rock up to a beer garden. And as soon as I'd arrive, people would say, oh, she's doing 1 year no beer. And then some people would just look, dart eyes over. And then somebody wide-eyed would say, why?
What's the reason?
Like you said earlier on, it gave me a huge appreciation for myself. And maybe it gave me something I never had before. And that was trust in myself. I never trusted myself before. And when I was able to eliminate that intoxication from my life, suddenly I was like, oh, there's a consistency in me that I never saw before.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, really like what you said is like making a stance. I'm affirmative here. I'm making a firm decision. I'm making a firm choice.
Mm.
And the confidence that grows by that. What it actually started to bring me down into was understanding energy and the mind and energy. And that started to get me to focus on a whole different side of me that was actually unknown parts of me that I hadn't even recognized or understood.
How do you go from playing football at an elite level to spirituality, to traveling to India, to meditation?
I had searched for so many answers. I'd gone seeking. I'm a big seeker wholeheartedly. I love the human form. I love the human nature and behaviors. Even before I began this spiritual awakening at that age, if you want to call it that, I was battling with huge bouts of anger and rage and frustration and all these raw emotions. No one could ever join the dots for me. And not until I met the chief and he started to join those dots. One of the first things he said to me was, the biggest thing you struggle with is your sensitivity. You're an extremely sensitive man. And I looked at him and I was like, oh my God, don't know what that means, but it feels really good. So there was huge parts of me that I did like. There was huge parts of me being the performer and everything else, but there was more parts of me that I didn't like. Mm. I started to go in search of that. I was like, right, what is it? I need to kind of get it because I'm battling with huge senses of ambition and massive amounts of regret.
So how then does a meditation practice free you from that regret, from that rage, from that dysfunction?
I was always trying to solve it by thinking, trying to think my way out of it. Yeah. And the more and more I tried to think my way out of it, the deeper and deeper I got in it.
Wow.
So, you know, there's a great saying, I hear people saying it now, and I used to have such a fear of losing my mind. But it wasn't until I lost my mind that everything else started to transform and to change. And they said, well, that's kind of counterintuitive. How are you going to process it without the mind? Well, it was the mind that was getting me into trouble, so losing it mightn't be such a bad thing. But therefore, taking the thinking and the cognitive element out of it, meditation and all those different elements started opening up the emotional. Had to feel my way out of it. If I said to you, just visualize this, or anyone that's listening to this, you know, everybody's trying to think their way out of a situation. But if you close your eyes and you visualize that, imagine being trapped in a dark room, pitch black. How are you going to get out of that room? Are you going to think your way out of it? Or what are you going to do? What's the first thing you will do? Pitch black, can't see a thing, no fragment of light, nothing.
I'll put my hands out to feel.
Yeah.
For the walls, for the door.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So therefore, when you go into deep states of meditation, you start to go into the void, into the darkness, all the unseen stuff.
Mm.
And you start to feel your way around it. Mm-hmm. You start to look around. And as you're looking around in your mind, you start to find the keys. Oh, that doesn't work. There's another key somewhere. Oh, that key works.
Mm.
Yeah. That allowed me then to look at breathing my way calm, that the breath became very important. And the relationship between my breath, my energy, and my mind was the key trinity at that time. So I started to explore them very, very, very deeply.
Breathing is an interesting one because I know enough now at this point to know the benefit of deep breathing practices. But I find that ultimately the sitting with yourself is difficult.
The body will believe the breath before it believes the mind.
Say more on that.
Well, the first place we will actually go to is we go to the reaction. So we'll go straight into our mind, trying to find a solution to what's occurred at that time, at that place. Therefore, when that actually happens, say a shock or a trauma comes in, the breath shortens. All of a sudden, the little bit of hyperventilation starts to come in. The stomach might start getting a bit queasy. We start getting a bit lightheaded. We start getting ungrounded, all those different elements in it. However, if we can really feel into the body and allow our breath to go deep when a vent happens to us, then all of a sudden, we'll be able to process it from a somatic place rather than from a mechanical place.
I'm just thinking about a scenario for me in the last week or so. An error happened at work on my watch, and I was properly in the eye of the storm. Mm-hmm. Even though I was in kind of problem-solving mode, I was aware of what was happening to my body. So like that, my breath got very shallow.
Yeah.
My mouth completely dry. My hands are sweating. Difficulty speaking, swallowing. Somebody was on the phone giving me instructions and I could hear them, but I wasn't listening.
Yeah. So where did your mind race to?
People will change their opinion of you. So you may as well just pack your bag and leave.
When did you feel your breath return?
I mean, 45 minutes later.
Yeah. Where did your mind come 45 minutes later?
It's only when I left the building and left the cocoon did the mind really come in and descend. And you had a very valuable piece of advice for me a while back. You know, I've often had bouts of depression and darkness in my life. And you had said to me, give your depression a name. And so I gave it the name Digby. And I have to tell you, like, Saturday evenings are my favorite time of the week. I finish work. I might go and do a little bit of work with the community kitchen in Tooting. And then I'll come home, put on a podcast, and I will just make my dinner and relax and think, happy weekend.
Yeah.
When I got home on Saturday, I didn't feel worthy of the ritual.
Yeah.
And Digby, I went, shut my front door, and Digby's toe was in the door, and he was my shadow for the last couple of days.
How did you handle Digby for the last 2 days then?
So I did speak to him. Mm-hmm. And I did say to him, listen, buddy, no, not now.
Yeah.
I don't want to have this conversation now. And on a couple of occasions, he left. But I could say the only time that I have been completely clear of him is when I went to do a class, an Inferno Hot Pilates class, hot room, bit of HIIT. That took me completely outside of myself. And then I had the endorphins coursing through my veins after it. And I was able to be like, back up. And then you remember again. And the worthiness piece comes in.
Yeah. It's like Digby comes in, pours a load of water on the fire. The fire goes out. And all you got is a load of steam and you're trying to get a hold of steam and it's intangible. Yes. And yet we go through that process till we ignite the fire again and we start to burn away that negativity. Hence yoga, hot yoga, meditation, pranayama. Mm-hmm. And we start to build that fire within. And, you know, that was like myself playing in front of 60,000, 80,000, 90,000 people. And how I regulated myself in that space for so many years, I just thought that was just the way it was and you just have to deal with it. But I never had a system that was in place or a program in place that allowed me to anchor me and to bring me back to a place of center, to actually understand where my spiral is taking me. When I get triggered, where am I spiraling off to? And oftentimes it was just spiraling off to the worst case, you know, but I lose my position and the sense of survival and security. So that's what I talk about now in terms of this isn't danger. Mm. isn't just a threat. Danger is real. I've started to have a misuse of my imagination and seeing the worst case scenario. So therefore, how can I bring it back to, right, I'm here, I am now. So where my breath and my meditation started to bring me understanding the difference between what's a danger and what's a threat.
Tell me about your beam sessions.
First off, beam is a beautiful word. And there's nothing better when you see someone and they're absolutely beaming. They're absolutely glowing. The funny thing is you see a lot of women today going around looking for collagen and looking for Botox and all those different things. The beauty of operating your breath, chanting mantra, all those different things, it's a natural collagen maker. It's a natural Botox effect. So in other words, you've been thinking you heard of Babas.
Yeah.
I met a Baba once. He was 102 and he looked about 50. He looked better than myself. Yeah. And he was amazing, you know. And I've been lucky enough to meet these people and to gain certain practices off them and initiations off them and stuff like that. Like, but take that for instance, you know.
So mantra and breathing can actually restore our collagen.
Well, I don't know in terms of deep restoration, but it definitely won't deplete it.
Mm.
You know, stress, anxiety, frustration will definitely remove it.
Yes.
Or maintaining it is the one. Look, we're all going to age. It's something that we have to get used to. And for me, spirituality is training for that transition, for that day to come. One of the biggest statements I love was Buddha. He was once asked, you know, what did he gain from meditation? And he said, I didn't gain anything from meditation. And the Chela disciple asked, what do you mean you didn't gain anything from it? You're telling us about you should meditate and do all that. He said, well, let me tell you what I lost. I lost fear, anxiety, frustration, agitation, anger, you name it. Lost all those different things. Mm-hmm. So in other words, that can only enhance our physiology or physicality.
I can see that in myself. I definitely was somebody who was in a very highly stressed environment. I would keep myself quite stressed and it was starting to show on my face. My skin was dull. My lines were deeper. I was aging at pace. And as soon as I picked up a meditation practice and I started to breathe and create space in my life for harmony and peace, suddenly I could see it.
Yeah.
In the mirror.
It's evident. And then you're meeting people. People are like, geez, you're looking great. You're beaming. So in other words, going back to originally what we're saying, what beam was understanding body, energy, awareness, and mind. And I found those four components were hugely valuable. And in the modern world, you know, we don't have caves to go sit and meditate in. I started in the spare room at the front of the house. Above it was our bedroom. And Ali, you'd be like, what are you actually making those sounds at 4 o'clock in the morning till 6 o'clock? So I built my office here, my meditation room, and a specific environment that I keep that vibration in between these four walls. It is difficult to get the time and the energy and the space to actually do it. So Beam was like a condensed the yogic practices down into seated yoga poses. So it can be done for any age. Then I go into pranayama, which is ancient breathing exercises. And then we finish off with mantra. And prime for me, the biggest key is mantra. Mantra and making those sounds and chanting is the key. But that's the hardest thing that people will find the hardest thing to actually do. It's amazing.
Hmm. Took me a long time to get into it, all right. Because not only is there an agitation in the body physically and a resistance to the practice, but then also, as you say, the awareness of those around you. What do my neighbors think? What do my family think?
And the funny thing is, I always go back to I used to love going out to my grandparents in Turlochmore, and all the old folk would come around in the evening, all the grandparents, all the other houses. It was like a community house and they'd all sit around the open hearth and the fire and stuff like that. And next thing, the bells of the Angelus would come on and when they'd start praying, I used to hear my grandparents, my grandmothers especially, and they'd be saying Our Father or Hail Mary, and it'd be the very same as listening to a chant in India or Tibet or hearing certain sounds of cheros in South America. It was just sound, you know. It's an amazing medicine.
Yeah. Well, look, this has been an amazing conversation. If you would like to get in touch with David for a beam session, what's your Instagram, David?
David Ford Pathfinder. And it runs on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesdays are off, Thursday, Friday. So 4 mornings. It's very flexible, but at the end of it, you're going to come out of a feeling fresh-eyed and bushy-tailed. And, you know, it's better than a cup of coffee. You're out the gap and you're out the door, like, you know. So anyone wants to get involved, let us know.
Fantastic. You're also a coach and mentor. So yeah, contact David on Instagram and pick your poison.
Give it a go.
Fantastic. Cheers, David.
Thank you, Claire. That was great. We finally did it.
We did it. We did it. Hey, thanks so much for listening. The Claire Solon podcast is a Nalos production and produced by Caroline Irwin. We would love to hear your feedback. You can give us a review on Apple or on Spotify. And hey, if you want to get in touch, how do they do it, producer Caroline?
Well, you can jump into the show notes and you can send us a WhatsApp from there, or you can email us at claresolonpodcast@gmail.com.
We look forward to hearing from you. See you next week.